name is Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeannie.
And I was thinking, sitting there, the stories a lot of you could tell about me. My sobriety date is March 8th, 1972. In 16 days, I will be 22 years clean and sober, and that's a damn good start. And I'm really not particularly worried about whether I'm going to make it or not. My higher power is pretty powerful. I was trying to think of how I could do this in an hour. The last time this fellow taped me, he said I went two. So during the night, I was saying, come on, God, how can we speed this thing up? I walked into off the streets to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, March 21st, 1972. I was 13 days clean and sober. My mother drove me up to the meeting. I had totaled my car my last day of drinking. She didn't want me to go to AA in her hometown, Spring Valley, New York. The lady at headquarters in New York said that there was a meeting Tuesday nights at the Presbyterian Church in Suffern, and Mother didn't know any Presbyterians in Suffern. So we drove up there, and on the way, she said to me, honey, are you sure you need to go? She said, you've been sober 13 days. You haven't taken a drink. You've proved you can do it. You don't know any of those people. Don't you think we just ought to go back home? And, you know, I really wanted to do that. I was scared of you people. I didn't know what you were like. I'd heard some rumors. I'd heard some myths. I'd heard some pretty unpleasant things. And in fact, I had called AA 2 years before. My husband and I had had one of those fights that only two alcoholics can have, where we'd said things that no two human beings should say to anybody else ever, ever, ever. And the next morning, sick with shame and guilt, in front of my children, incidentally, our children, the next morning I went to the telephone, I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, I dialed them, and the operator, it must have been an answering service, the operator asked me for my full name and telephone number, and I panicked and slammed the phone down because my father-in-law, an alcoholic physician, and my husband, an alcoholic physician, would have killed me if they had ever found I had called Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I didn't. 2 years went by. In those 2 years, I lost my husband, my children, my home, all the friends that we had made in 21, 22 years of marriage. I was a skid row bum, a liar, a cheat, a thief, a bum, and a whore by the time I came to recovery. And so I looked at Mother, and I wanted to go back home. I wanted to watch television. I didn't want to risk meeting new people. And instead, what happened was that the warning bells went off in my head. It was the first time it ever happened. But behind my head, there were warning bells. And I really knew that if I didn't go to AA that night, I'd probably not go to AA, and I would end up drunk again, and I would end up the way I had been, a liar, a cheat, a thief, a bum, and a whore. And so I said to my mother, no, Mother, I need to go to AA. You don't have to go to Al-Anon, but I need to go to AA. And my mother was one of those mothers that would have, if I asked her to die for me, would have died for me. I loved that when Tom said that last night, because that was my mother. And my mother said, oh, no, dear. She had been told by the lady at headquarters in New York that if I were an alcoholic, I had a better chance of getting well if she joined Al-Anon. And so my mother, at 78 years of age, joined Al-Anon. And she was a member of Al-Anon until her death at 86 years of age, attending never less than 3 times a week. My mother was the kind of mother who put her actions where her mouth was. If I was going to go to AA, she was going to go to Al-Anon. I will be forever grateful. By God's grace, I walked in off the streets to Alcoholics Anonymous to a step meeting. And from the first night on, I never had any question that the method of recovery that AA used was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I left the meeting that evening, ladies thrust into my hand a couple pamphlets back in the twin bed that I had slept in when I was a child at my mother's home. I read the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember the pamphlet, but I do remember the steps. And I read step one, where it said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I don't know about you, but to me, that's the most beautiful poetry I've ever read in my life, because that's the answer that I had been seeking. That's the answer I had been looking for. For years, I could not understand what was the matter with me. For years, I didn't know what was wrong. And then I read that step that night, and that's what I had been looking for, because you see, many times I could go days or even weeks without drinking, but when I started to drink again, I couldn't stop drinking. And many, many times I still could control my behavior. But sometimes I couldn't control my behavior and I would disgrace myself in public. And to me, that was powerless. Powerless over whether I would drink or not, powerless over my behavior, and certainly powerless over the quantity I would drink. And so I loved that step. And I lay there and I thought, thank God. I was an atheist. I thought, oh, just ecstatic to finally see the truth. The second step was came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I'm glad I did not see the capital on the P, the capital on the power, because I was a pseudo-intellectual. I had spent years studying at many universities to confirm the fact that religious people were just weaklings, they were just fanatics, they couldn't stand alone in the world, and so they had to have some mythology to support themselves with. And so for some reason, I didn't see the capital P on power, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I wasn't sure I could take that step because, you see, I was insane. I had no question about that whatsoever. My psychiatrist had been one of my husband's professors from medical school. And when I had made my first suicide attempt at 33 years of age, my husband had decided that I needed some psychiatric help. And he remembered that Dr. Kammer, he's dead now, had bragged about drinking a fifth a day, and my husband figured that Dr. Kammer wouldn't mess with our drinking, and so I went to see Dr. Kammer. And I told him the truth, as much truth as I could possibly tell him. And when I finished that interview, I remember him looking at me before he reached in his bottom drawer to get samples of drugs out. I remember him looking at me and saying, well, Jeannie, I'll see you once a week for 3 months and I'll have you fixed by the end of that time. 6 years later, I was still seeing him 1 and 2 times a week. I had had so many hospitalizations at his private psychiatric hospital in New York, I do not know how many times I was admitted to that hospital. I had had 27 shock therapies, series of 6, series of 9, and series of 12. Why there is any brain left, I have no idea whatsoever, and never once was it suggested to me that I had a problem with alcohol. I had the facility to rage when I was drinking. Maybe some of you know what I talk about. I could go 2 weeks, maybe, max, without raging. 2 weeks I could be seductive and social and pleasant and all those things when I drank. Sooner or later, though, and no later than 14 days, as I started to drink and communicate with my husband, we confused drinking together with intimacy. I don't know if any of you did that. And so we would start to drink together, and I would start to tell him what had bothered me about him that day. And if I got away with that, then I told him what had bothered me about him last week and 5 weeks ago and a year ago and 10 years ago. And I could rage 5 hours, 5 hours. And so the next morning I would always, we called it that I splattered against the wall because I would just blow and I would go on and on. And I would crucify everything there was about that man, everything there was. And the next morning, sick with guilt and shame, I would crawl into New York and go to see Dr. Kammer, and I would say to him, sometimes, sort of weakly, I would say to him, you know, Dr. Kammer, I only do these things when I've been drinking. And he would say, now, Jean, let's not blame your behavior on your drinking. Let's not blame your behavior on your drinking. And so 6 years later, and finally that my last year of drinking, or a year before I came to recovery, my husband said he couldn't go on any longer, and I admit that. I do not blame him. He was trying to manage our home, our daughters, the people who work for us. He was trying to manage his medical practice, and he was trying to manage 6 to 8 hours of drinking a day. And something had to give, and it was me. Something had to give, and it was me. And Dr. Kammer agreed with him, and I moved into a little apartment about a mile away from our home. My last year, free to the constraints of trying to manage a home and trying to manage 2 daughters, I had gotten into around-the-clock drinking, and finally, thank God, ended up on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when it said came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, I didn't think for me that was going to be possible. My diagnoses varied with his drugs and my orthopedist and my gynecologist and my husband and my brother-in-law and my father-in-law. I had 7 pushers. I am not only an alcohol addict, I'm a medications addict, And so when I say I'm clean and sober almost 22 years, it means that that's what the medications were. My diagnoses have been borderline schizophrenic, obsessive compulsive neurotic, I'll buy that one. I've used that for recovery. You know, I thought that was the one I'd stick with. I like that one. That'd do. Bipolar depressive, chronic depressive. Every time he changed my medications, he would then change my diagnosis. And so I lay there that night, and I didn't think I could be sane, but I did think at least I couldn't, maybe I would learn how not to drink any longer, how I would learn not to drink any longer. The third step is came to believe that a power greater than our, third step is made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understood him. And I know this is rank heresy in this area of the country, but thank God I got well in New York State where they had other atheists. And when I saw that and I realized the implication of that step, I knew I couldn't take it. And I was very sad, and reluctantly I prepared to leave AA. And I said to the lady who later became my sponsor, I can't stay if I have to believe in God in order to be a member. And she said, oh, no, no, Jeannie, for heaven's sakes, you don't have to believe in God. Peggy over there is 7 years sober, and she's an atheist. And I looked at Peggy, and I liked the outfit she had on, and liked the way she had her hair done, and I thought, okay, I'll stay. And when I was in graduate school a few years later at the University of Arizona, my phone rang, and it was Peggy, and she was in school in San Francisco, and she said, did you find God yet? And I said, yes, did you? She said, yes, and that's all I remember of the phone call, but God is great and God is good. He let me get well where I could get well. I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of AA for 6 months, and I figured if at the end of that time my life weren't better, forget it, I was going to go back to drinking and drugging. And at the end of 6 months, my life was no better. Okay, in fact, my life was a little bit worse because I had to take a lot of consequences for the things that I had done in the course of my alcoholism. I don't know about you, but my pink cloud wore thin relatively rapidly. At 6 months, the phone rang. It was Thanksgiving. And it was a woman who had worked for us for many years. I'd hung out near the phone all day long because I just knew my children were home with their father from boarding school, and they would realize how lonely it was without me there at home, and so they would be calling me to invite me to Thanksgiving. So I didn't even get very far from the phone in the apartment. I just stayed right close to it. And about 2, the phone rang, and I was dressed nicely, so in case, you know, for when they called, I wouldn't have to change. And I ran to the phone, and I picked it up, and it was Nellie, an old Polish lady. We used to call her our third mother. And she said, Happy Thanksgiving, Pani. And I said, Happy Thanksgiving, Nellie. And I thought, oh, she's calling for the children. And she said, Pani, you know what happened? Pani is a term of respect in Polish. She said, do you know what happened Monday, Pani? And I said, no, Nellie. What happened Monday? And she said, Pan doctor divorce you Monday, Pani. Pan doctor divorce you Monday. And I was devastated, but I know how to fake, I know how to cover, I know how to look not vulnerable. And I said, oh, that's okay, Nellie, we can always get remarried. And then she started to cry, and she said, Pani, you know what happened yesterday? And I said, no, Nellie, what happened yesterday? She said, Pani, Pan doctor marry somebody else. Pan doctor marry somebody else. And I said all the right things, and I covered, and I looked good on the phone, and I made her feel all right, and as soon as I got off the phone, I fell to the floor, sobbing and crying, heartbroken, furious, terrified, and all of a sudden I had a brilliant idea. All of a sudden I had a brilliant idea, and I sat up, and I wiped my face, and I said to myself, I'll fix him, I'll get drunk. But thank God for a man named Tom who taught me an afterlog. He had said, when I thought that, the next thing I must think is, no, I'll fix him, I'll stay sober. And I stood up and I said, no, I'll fix him, I'll stay sober. And that was 21 years ago. And I'm still fixing him, I'm still staying sober. I had an opportunity to see him 4 years ago at our younger daughter's wedding. Luckily, at the last moment, my sister-in-law, who was an active alcoholic, his sister turned to me and she said, you will not recognize Stanley. And very archly, I turned to her. I said, Barbara, I was married to him for almost 23 years. Of course, I'll remember him. I'll recognize him. And she put up with me, and she said, "Jean, you will not recognize Stanley. Thank God I had met his wife earlier in the day. I would not have recognized him." In the door of this restaurant for the rehearsal dinner came this obese, grotesque caricature of a man. A bloated, bloated face, belly out to here, frontal lobe lesions, flopped feet. Ill, 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 ill. And I didn't know what to do. I wouldn't have known him if she had not been trying to hold him up. And so I went over and I stuck my hand out. I had rehearsed that maybe for 18 years. And it wasn't what I thought. And I walked over, I stuck my hand out, and I said, "Hi, Stanley, I'm Jean." And all he was able to say was, "Fat, fat, fat." And I said, "What do you say when somebody, that's a sentence, fat, fat, fat? What do you say when this is somebody you produce two children with?" And I said, "Well, you look very well." "What do you say? You look like hell? Is that you? You know?" A year and a half ago, my older daughter married, and as we started out, my sister was there, and is my very perfect sister. Do any of you have a perfect sister? My very perfect sister started out, and I started out into the reception, and at the last minute, it occurred to me, and my sister's 6 feet tall, so I always do this when I talk to her, and I looked up, and I said, "Jack, you won't recognize Stanley." And she said to me, "Jean, he was my brother-in-law for 22, 23 years. Of course I will recognize him." And I said, "Jackie, you won't recognize Stanley." She said, "Jean, you know, you may be nasty, but I'm not." So she went on across the pool, and I went somewhere else, and a few minutes later, she stood beside me, ashen, absolutely white. And she said, "My God, I never would have known him. My God, I never would have known him." And at the end, not even at the end of the reception, relatively early in the evening, an hour or two later, there was his wife trying to get him out of the door to take him back to the hotel. And my sister hissed down at me, "You better be damn glad she got him." And I said, I am. And I don't mean that as unkindly as I sound. I pray for them every single morning and every single night. And whenever I see the name Stanley, I pray for them. And I say, "Please, dear God." I don't think he would make much of an AA these days. I don't think his brain is left. But I used to think what a wonderful AA he would make and how many lives he would touch, because he was one of the finest, one of the most decent young men I have ever known, ever known. And so there seems to be this awful inequity. It's not for me to say, but why do some of us get well and so many do not? So many do not. So made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. At 6 months, he had divorced me. My life was not better, but I was a little bit better, because by then I had heard, "Don't quit before your miracle." By then, people had assured me that if I would just not take a drink or a fix, if I would just make one meeting a day, if I would just work the steps, sooner or later the miracles would begin in my life. So I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of AA, and I continued in that decision for several years. The fourth step is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I read everything I could lay my hands on how to do it, and I was totally confused. And of course, I had this fogged up brain from 14 years of drinking and about 17 years of mood-altering medications. Tranquilizers, sleeping pills, painkillers. I was supposedly dying of something very rare. I had been in a back brace by the time I came to recovery, 4 years, and a neck brace 1 year. But anyway, I couldn't figure out how to do the fourth step. I asked my first sponsor, and she said, "Oh, nobody can tell you how to do the fourth step, dear. You'll have to figure out that out yourself." I think she didn't know how. I could retain if I read were the little jokes at the end of the articles in the Reader's Digest. I couldn't read the whole article. I couldn't retain, but those little jokes I could. And one night, trying to kill time, I read one of those little blurbs, and it said, "In this permissive day and age, we have come to view the Ten Commandments as the Ten Suggestions." Now, I know this is not AA talk, but this is what I did. "In this permissive day and age, we have come to view the Ten Commandments as the Ten Suggestions." And I laughed with all my pseudo-intellectualism. Of course they're just suggestions. Of course they're just compilations of man's accumulated wisdom. And I laughed and I laughed. And I laughed for the next 2 weeks every time I thought about it, with decreasing strength. You know that? It finally ended up sort of a worried little chuckle. You know. And I finally got honest enough. You say you don't suppose they are commandments. You don't suppose there is a God who directly communicated with man and gave that. So I had asked somebody where they were in the Bible, and I looked them up, and I got 10 typewriter pages, and I put a commandment at the top of each page because I was trying to see where I went wrong. And when I looked back, I looked at how I had felt about that commandment or behaved toward that commandment as a small child, as an adolescent, as a young married woman, and as a card-carrying alcoholic. And I did all 10 commandments that way, and when I finished, I was absolutely dumbfounded. Absolutely dumbfounded, because you see, I had wanted to blame all my problems on my drinking. We didn't read the big book in the East in those days, and again, I know that's rank heresy. We read the 12 by 12, and I hadn't seen that drinking is but a symptom of our illness. But there was evidence of it, because my character defects did not start when I began to drink at 25, 26 years of age. They didn't start when I began to take phenobarb during my pregnancies at 21 and 23 years of age. My character defects went back to in utero, in very early childhood, in very early childhood. I wasn't a liar. I didn't start to lie at 25 years of age when I started to drink. I started to lie at 3 years of age when somebody said, Jean Rigaud, who... Not me, the cat, the dog, my sister, who everybody else was always to blame, always to blame. That was my first four step, and I'll tell you, it changed my life, because I could see that I was a sitting duck character-wise for my alcoholism long before I ever picked up a drink or a pill. The fifth step is admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being. Now, you can all feel sort of superior about my four step, but I'll tell you, I did a good fifth step. I knew a Roman Catholic priest who was 14 years sober. And I phoned Father Dave and I asked him to hear my fifth step. And the reason I asked him to hear my fifth step was not any particular theological or religious persuasion. It was because I knew the stories about him, and he had been even kinkier than I had been in the course of his alcoholism. And like so many of us, the last thing in the world I wanted to be was judged. I could not have had somebody hear my fifth step that would judge me. Now, I will tell you that the Father Dave was very proud of the fact that he had quit smoking 3 or 4 months before, and he resumed smoking during my fifth step. Because, you see, my husband had been chief of gynecology at 2 hospitals, and I had been on a lot of the guilds there, and I had been in junior league and president of the chairperson of the mayor's urban renewal committee, and I had been busy being Mrs. Lady Do-Gooder, okay, during the day, so I could drink and drug and screw around that night, okay? I had a public persona that I presented, a public personality, and I had a whole hidden, sickening, deviant life at night. And so as he heard this, all he knew me as is Mrs. So-and-so, okay, and already heard this garbage out of this nice-looking 40-year-old woman's mouth, and it was more than he could take. But I was as honest as I could be, and I left some stuff out, not deliberately. I left some stuff out just simply because it had not bubbled to the surface through the other filth yet. But I shared with Father Dave, and mine was a moral inventory. I've heard people say, well, it's not an... Mine was an immoral inventory, rather. I've heard people say, well, it's not to be an immoral inventory. Mine was an immoral inventory because somehow I had to get rid of that guilt that I had been trying to drink away for years. And what I needed to do was to tell somebody all the things that I had done that even I knew were wrong. I knew we're wrong. And when I finished that inventory, I didn't have that great release and that wonderful energy. I was dead tired. I was confused, and I wondered if I had done a good job. And Father Dave said, go home, read the sixth step and the seventh step, and when other stuff starts to come up, call me. And I said, oh, Father Dave, I've told you everything. He said, when other stuff starts to come up, call me, Jeannie. And it did, and I don't always share this from the podium, but I will today at the risk of being in a Catholic community, and I am Roman Catholic. I was at my first AA convention. I have a young woman that I have the privilege of being with, as a sponsor, here with me today, and it's her first AA convention. And I was telling her about my first AA convention, which was in the Catskills at a Jewish resort. I didn't know anybody there, but I went. And the first speaker I ever heard that I remember was Dave from the dentist, the Jewish dentist from Dallas. Oh, what a night that was. What a night that was. I forget where I was going with this. My first AA convention. Oh. Oh, I lost that one. Oh, call me when the other stuff comes up. Thank you. What I need that. I don't know about any of you, but I need that. I need somebody to keep track of where I'm at, and I don't tease when I say that. I'm grateful for that. Going into, they were having Mass the next morning, and I was where I got well in AA, they told us to find a church as soon as possible. They didn't say we had to believe in the church. They just said the advice was to find a church where you didn't want to vomit. And start going to that. So I had started. I went back to the church of my childhood, which was Methodist, and damn near puked all over the guy's feet. And I went back to my church of my marriage, which was Catholic, and I didn't want that either. So I ended up in a different church where I was lusting after the minister. Guy's builds. This guy had a fanny, the kind I liked. You know, I don't know how the other equipment was, but the fanny looked good. And I used to sit there and fantasize, not fantasize, I believed it was going to happen. I thought God put him in my path because God wanted me to have him, and pretty soon he would see me, and he would leave that wife of his, and he and I would live happily ever after. Well, that was never to happen. But it kept me going to church while, you know, so I could be there when he was ready, yeah? And so being in church wouldn't be a total waste. I used to try and pry my mind open each Sunday to try and listen to a little bit of what he said. Anyway, so by the time of this first conference, I went to, there was no other church service office, so I went to Mass that particular morning. Time had changed, and some man and I had not realized it, and he and I were both standing in the lobby waiting. And so when we realized that Mass was not for another hour, he said, come on, I'll buy you a cup of coffee. And as we talked, it turned out he had heard Father Dave's fifth step, too. Y'all like coincidences? And so we talked, and then we went back down, and time to receive communion. And I said, go ahead. He said, no. He said, I don't receive communion from anybody other than Father Dave because I may have killed a man. And so I stood up and I started up the aisle, and I have a problem with self-righteousness. I don't know if any of you do. I can frequently get self-righteous. And I received the communion, and I popped it in my mouth, and I started back down the aisle, and I was thinking, well, thank God, of all the things I did, I never killed anybody. Thank God, of all the things I did, I never killed anybody. You know that plexiglass 2x4 that hangs behind our head? You can't see it, but it's there, and then all of a sudden, you remember something, it just comes down and wallops your one. Well, it came down, and it hit me on the back of the head, and I damn near fell forward. Because when I made that self-righteous statement, all of a sudden my two abortions came to the surface. And I had not thought of those two abortions in my 6 months of sobriety. Okay, I had not thought of those. And I was absolutely devastated. And I called Father Dave. I was terrified. I called Father Dave and I said, I want to see you. He said, can't you cover it on the phone, dear? I said, no, this is a person-to-person thing. And I drove down and I saw him. Thank God Father Dave knew something I didn't know. You see, Father Dave, with his 14 years of sobriety, knew that it was a loving, caring God. And no matter what we had done, that God didn't give a darn. All that God wanted us to do is say, I'm sorry, and for us to turn back. That's all that God wanted us to do. And that particular day, I said, can you ever give me absolution? He said, certainly. With shaking hand, he gave me absolution. And I was to learn the truth that that's a loving, caring God, and frankly, he doesn't give a damn whatever I have done. All he wants me to do is acknowledge when I have done wrong, ask for his forgiveness, and he does nothing other than shower me with his kindnesses and his love and his caring and his guidance and his direction. I will always be grateful for Father Dave and my fifth step. The sixth step is became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I thought sort of a general confession would do. Climbed into my chair and I got what I thought was dutifully spiritual, and I said, okay, God, would you remove all my character defects? And nothing happened. So I got a little more spiritual and deeper breath, and I asked him again, and nothing happened. I didn't even sneeze or anything else. Nothing happened. And so a little bit discouraged, I climbed out of the chair. And I was to discover over the years that my character defects are only relieved as I surrender to them. And it is my experience and my sobriety that as I grow in my own recovery, and my God allows me to see a character defect more and more and more clearly. And I'm one of these modern people. I buy the self-help books. You know, I do that. I don't waste too much money on that stuff any longer. I find most of the answers are in the big book, and I don't really have to buy anything else. But every once in a while. And I've spent years in therapy, and I've spent years trying to do it myself. And where I'm at now is I know that the seventh step works. God allows me to become aware of a defect of character, so much until it is killing me. Right now, the one that he's allowing me to see, and it is killing me, is that I have a need to be right. I don't get the sickest beginner, and I've got to be right. I can't say, you may be right. I can't say, well, that's one way of looking at it. By God, I got to get the last word, and I've got to be right. And this character, none of you do this in this room, right? And this character defect at this point is choking me. I had a fight the other morning with a sick 2.5-year-old kid. That here I am, 61 years old. I should have been able to say to him, well, that's one way of looking at so long. Okay, but I've got to be right. And only what I know about this particular character defect and the preceding ones is only when I am so humbled about my own inability to do anything about that character defect that defeated, I am willing to sink to my knees and beg God to do something. Will he do anything? And he will either remove it or diminish it or give me the strength to live with it. Please don't give me the strength to live with this one. You know, take it away, okay, take it away. Seventh step is a reality for me as it's written. The eighth step is made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I assured my sponsor that I didn't need to write this out because I had it all up here. And she said, what color was your birthday dress when you were 9, dear? I said, I don't know. And she said, but that's up there too, dear. She said, in other words, you've forgotten a few things. She said, let's put it down on paper. Let's put it down on paper. And I didn't want to do that. After all, who could I have harmed? Okay, who could I have harmed? And two nights in a row, I went to topic discussion meetings, which turned out to be 8-step meetings. And when I got to those 8-step meetings, people redefined harm for me. They said that the 8th step was a written step, that we put the initials of the person we had harmed, and we put a paragraph about specific ways we had harmed them. Not generalizations, specific ways. And that harmed was lives I had had a negative effect on. Harmed meant lives I had a negative effect on. I wanted harmed to be waitresses that I had stiffed, bartenders that I had flipped the bird to, you know. And when she said that, or they said that nasty thing about that harmed meant lives I had a negative effect on, it rang in that inner place. It was another warning bell. And the next morning, I crawled out of bed and I got a legal pad. And I sat down and I began to look back over my whole life, and it doesn't say since we began drinking. I began to look over my whole life for lives that would have been better off without me, for a day or two or a week or two or a month or two, or many for years would have been better off without me. And absolutely dumbfounding, I think that's one of my favorite steps, because that day was my moment of clarity. I, who, like so many of us, said, my drinking hasn't harmed anybody but me, could see in clarity that my drinking had had a negative effect on many, many, many people. Many. My husband was on that list. You see, the thing is, I didn't want to put his name down because he had harmed me far more than I had harmed him. Bunko. What that step says in the big book is setting aside resolutely the harm others have done us. We look only at the harm we had done them. And when I wrote that paragraph about what I had done to that fine young man, okay, what I had done to him, how I had affected his life, I cannot tell you my grief and my guilt. Cannot tell you. And my mother, I said that my mother had never seen me drunk, therefore why should I make amends to her? My mother fell asleep on her knees the last 10 years of my drinking on a hardwood floor by her bed. She had thanked God for her daughter, Aida. She had thanked God for her daughter, Jackie. And she had ended up sobbing herself to sleep with her face on her bedspread, begging God to do something about her daughter, Jean. She could take pride in her daughter, Aida. She could take pride in her daughter, Jackie. And I was a source of heartache, shame, and guilt. That's a life I had a negative effect on. and Heidi and Tara, my daughters. Lives I had negative effects on. It was all there. And for me, for some of you that seems shaming, for me that was the freedom step. For me that was the step where I could see that I would do whatever it took the rest of my life to make sure I never harmed the people again that I had thought I had loved. That I had thought I had loved. For me, the eighth step was the freedom step. The big book says we're like the farmer who comes out of the wind cellar. His whole farm's been blown away in a tornado, but instead he looks at the sky and he says to his wife, "Ain't it nice now, Ma? The wind stopped blowing." And I could see the tornado. I could see the devastation in our lives, in the lives of the people that I had thought I had loved, thought I had loved. The ninth step is made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Conway is here, and he's your next speaker this morning, and I don't think he knows the coincidence that he's sort of responsible for in my life. I only heard my older daughter's voice a few times in my first 5 years of recovery. And my first 9.5 years of recovery, I never heard my younger daughter's voice. You mothers know, though we love them all the same, right, there's one that lies closer to our heart. There's one that's called the heart child. And Tara was my heart child, and for 9.5 years, she hated me so, I never heard her voice. And one day, I was at a treatment center in Denver, and the phone rang. I wasn't supposed to be there. A friend of mine was coming off Valium, and she was crazier than a bed bug, and the staff wanted to kick her out, so I had her in my office. I was hiding her from them for the afternoon, at least I figured it. And the phone rang, and I wasn't supposed to answer it. Nobody knew I was there, and I kept ringing, and finally I walked over, and I picked it up, and I said, well, I'm getting ahead of my story, because that has to do with it. Hang on to that one. Don't quit before your miracle, okay? But I was very aware when I read that Conway was here and that he didn't know what one of his conferences had done for me. I became willing to live my amends. I lived my amends to my mother for 9 years, my first 9 years of my recovery. Well, frankly, I was a bitch the first 2 years, but I sort of got the program a little straighter at 2 years, and I had 7 years to live my amends to my mother, 7 years to be the daughter I wanted to be. I thought initially that the ninth step, amends, made a direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, was a confession and apology step. My second sponsor is a man who's now 39 years sober. He's dying of cancer. He means the world to me. It will be a loss beyond what I can conceive when he goes. But at that time, I said to him something about confession and apology. He said, "Jeannie, how many times have you confessed and apologized?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, Bob, why?" And he said, 500, 1,000 times? He said, "How many times have you said, 'I'm sorry, I'll never do it again, please forgive me'?" I said, 1,000, 500, 5,000? And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't you think that's enough of that? Nobody's going to believe you." He said, "That is not a confession and apology step, that's a living step. You live those amends. You put back in the lives in a positive way that you have negatively affected." And so I began to do that. I tried to do it with my mother. I tried to do it with my sister. I tried to do it with the people that God put in my path. And to this day, I am live my amends. It's one of the greatest joys I have is to be able to do for the people I harmed. And don't call this codependency. I get so tired of the fact that whenever we do for anybody else, it's labeled codependency. Bunko, that's not what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says. We put back into the lives that we have negatively affected. And you know, that's a miracle step too, because I have discovered as I put back into the lives that I have negatively affected, I reap harvests and rewards that I cannot conceive of. And so I live my amends. And the eighth and ninth step are not so that other people feel good about me. The eighth and ninth step are not so everybody says, "Oh, isn't Jeannie wonderful? Isn't Jeannie marvelous?" There are still people in this world that would like me to fall off the edge of the earth and not come back, okay? The eighth and ninth step are so I feel good about me, so that I can walk free in the world, so that I can have dignity and self-respect, so that I don't have to hide, I don't have to grovel, and I don't have to be ashamed. Tenth step is continue to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. And this is a daily step. And the funny thing is, I didn't do the steps in order. Again, rank heresy. I wasn't able to. I didn't know right from wrong by the time I came to recovery. I literally did not know right from wrong. Had you asked me what my moral structure was, I would have laughed and told you I was a moral relativist. That means I had no morals. Okay? When I was with you, I adopted yours, and when I was with you, I adopted yours. I had no standards and values. In the course of my alcoholism and my medication addiction, I had drunk and drugged my way out of all my standards and values. I was a chameleon who would do what I wanted to do at the moment. And so I began a daily inventory simply because I wanted to learn right from wrong again. I wanted to learn right from wrong with adult eyes, not children's eyes. And I began to try and do what's right and avoid what's wrong. And I didn't know how to do that, so I had to read stuff to learn how to do that. And I had to put back into my life an adult value system, one not that I had been given, but one that I chose. One not that I had been given, but one that I chose. And the daily 10th step was a way I did it. Of course, when we're wrong, promptly admit it, caught in my craw day in and day out. But eventually I was to learn just self-protection, that it was easier to admit it right away than to defend myself to myself for 3 or 4 days. And so that step became a reality too. The 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. For me, that was an arduous task. I haunted the paperback bookstores. I couldn't afford more. I would stand in front of the religious book section and the paperback section, and I would try and find a book where I didn't want to puke on the first 2 pages. And then I would buy that book and I would take it home, and I would read it until I couldn't stand it any longer. Then I would set it aside, and a few months later I would come back and I would try it again, and I would try it again. And, you know, I know this is not program, but I had to learn God. I had to learn God. I forgot to tell you something marvelous happened. I told you I did the very best 5th step I knew how. I swept the searchlight over the nook and cranny of my life, and I tried to cover everything. And shortly thereafter, I had one of those miraculous things happen, not the white light. That never happened for me. But I was to be given conscious contact. Somehow I had sensed that conscious contact was not just man trying to reach God. I guess somebody told me that, because I couldn't have known it myself. What I discovered conscious contact to be was God reaching me. And after the 5th step, and I really think not the 9th step, the 5th step, I was given conscious contact. And I had to find out what this being, this power, this divinity was that was trying to reach me. And so I studied, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I have a young friend in Dallas call me one time. She said, "Jeannie, my program's just been ruined." I said, "How's your program just been ruined?" She said, "People told me I love to pray for my mother and father and my family, and they say I can only pray for knowledge of God's will." I said, "Oh, Kathleen, that's a 10. She said, "What do you mean a 10? I said, "Well, you know, Bo Derek, she's a 10. She said, "Right, what's this have to do with Bo Derek?" I said, "That praying only for knowledge of his will is a Bo Derek. It's a 10. That's something we wish we could be, but we never get to." She said, "Oh, thanks, Jean, that's an AFCO," and she started to hang up. Do you all know what AFCOs are? Okay, some of you do. AFCOs are another effing growth opportunity. At this point in my sobriety, I would not dream of leaving the house without having done prayer and meditation, and I mean that with all my heart and soul. I have not left my home without doing prayer and meditation since 1987. Okay, behavior modification. My days, if I do prayer and meditation, my days go well. If I do my prayer and meditation, it's like skiing down a sunlit slope through the slalom poles of God's will. It is a marvelous journey each day, if I do my prayer and meditation. If I don't, it's not so good. And that's not the words I wanted to use. But anyway, what I do is prayer and meditation. I do what it tells me to do. It's there in the instructions. The 12th step is, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not as a result of these steps, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And the neat thing for me is, in doing the steps, I discovered the principles by which I live. A guy named Sid Simons, Dr. Sid Simons, says that, he says values are the stars by which we navigate our lives. The old sailors used to look at the stars and then navigate across the sea. And principles, to me, principles are the stars by which I navigate my life. Now that I have principles, I am no longer a, billiard ball carouming across a billiard table. I no longer have difficulty making decisions because I have standards, I have values, and I have principles, and they make my life easy. I hope not rigid and flexible, but easy. I wanted to talk about Don't Quit Before Your Miracle so I can tell the story about Conway's conference. They told me not to quit before my miracle. When I got the news from Nellie about Stanley, I thought of about a drink, and then I thought, no, I'll fix him. I'll stay sober. When I was a year sober, I went to my children's boarding school. I looked better. I wasn't so skinny. I wasn't so emaciated. My muscle tone was beginning to return. I dressed as nicely as I could, had my hair done, drove up to their school in this little Volkswagen Beetle I had bought. The dean of women came down. She said to me, oh, Mrs. Wagren, you look so good. You look so well. What has happened? And I said to her, oh, madame, she was French, oh, madame, I have joined AA. I was an alcoholic. And she started to cry. She said, oh, I'll go get the girls. I said, and today is my first birthday. And she came downstairs in about 15 minutes, now really crying, and she said, I do not know how to tell you this, madame. She said, but your daughters will not see you. Your daughters will not see you. Okay? And I drove back down the Hudson, and I drove to a meeting. And I didn't take a pill, and I didn't take a drink, and I didn't take a fix, and I went to a meeting. Because people in AA had told me that if I didn't quit, pretty soon my miracles would start. When I was 18 months, my phone rang one morning. Picked up the phone, and it was my daughter, Heidi. She was back from Spain. I said, Heidi, oh, it's so good to hear your voice. And she started to talk. She told me she'd come home to marry her fiancé, who was dying of Hodgkin's. And she told me about her wedding dress and her trousseau and her wedding preparations. And all of a sudden, I looked at my watch, and I realized that I was going to be late. And I was a trainee at a treatment center, big mental health treatment center back east. And I said to her, oh, hi, I'm awfully sorry. I have a job, and I have to be at work on time. But I tell you what, honey, as soon as I get back, I'll call you this afternoon. And all of a sudden, there was dead silence. My daughter, Heidi, said to me, oh, mother, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. She said, I was so nervous when I called you. She said, I just called to ask you two things. And she said, I was so nervous, I just started rattling. And I said, well, what did you want, honey? What are the two things? She said, I called to ask you, please, never to phone me again. And don't come to my wedding. Don't come to my wedding. Lifted up in hope and smashed down again. The consequences of my behavior, the consequences of the things that I had done throughout her life and her father's life. And I walked into the bathroom and I bathed and I dressed. I remember putting my lipstick on. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, they had told me that God can straighten out everything bad that happens. Romans 8:28, everything works together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Okay, but in AA, they just say God will make good come out of bad. And I stood in that mirror putting lipstick on and I thought, what in the world good can come out of this kind of pain? And then I realized that not once in 20 minutes had I thought of a drink or a pill. Not once in 20 minutes have I thought of one of those funny little hand-rolled cigarettes. Okay. For the next 2 weeks, there wasn't a moment, waking or sleeping, that I didn't think about a chemical way to kill the pain. A chemical way to kill the pain, and preferably me while I was at it. But they had told me in Alcoholics Anonymous not to quit before my miracle. They said if I just continued on going to meetings, working the steps, and not using mood-altering chemicals, sooner or later God would produce miracles in my life. When I was 3 years sober, at the University of Arizona, they removed a hole in my face, a sore. And the surgeon called me in, and he was crying, and he said, Jeannie, it's malignant melanoma. And I remember standing there and thinking, my God, how do I stay sober through this? New slogan, how do I stay sober through this? I was pissed as hell at God. Here I was going to graduate school, learning how to be of use in the world, and he would let this happen to me. And for 30-some-odd days, I ranted and raved at God. For 30 days, but I made a meeting a day, and I didn't take a drink, I didn't take a pill, I didn't take one of those funny little hand-rolled cigarettes. Okay? And 30-some-odd days, one of the women I sponsor came into the meeting, without belaboring it, her husband was one of the foremost experts in the world on breast cancer, and a friend of theirs had just died of malignant melanoma. That's why she was late. And it occurred to me, I better call Art. If there's any chance, I better call Art. So I called Art. He had the slides picked up, and a few days later, he appeared at my apartment, and he said, Jeannie, I'm speaking now as if your father-in-law and your husband were sober. I'm speaking for them. I'm speaking for them. Do you trust me? And I said, yes, I do. He said, it looks like malignant melanoma, but I have three pathologists that agree it is not. Malignant melanoma was terminal in those days. What if I'd taken a pill? What if I'd taken a drink? What if I'd taken one of those little hand-rolled cigarettes? I wouldn't be here with you today. But I hadn't quit before my miracle. At 5 years driving back east, I stopped at our restaurant. What are two drunks? My husband and I had bought a restaurant. Stopped at our, in the days when I was drinking. I stopped at the restaurant. One of our partners said to me, you're going to call Heidi Jeannie? I said, no, Hank, no point in calling her. She never will speak to me. He reached across the desk. He said, Heidi, this is Uncle Hank. Your mother's here. Come over. And Heidi came over to the restaurant. Now, it wasn't sweetness and light. It wasn't the way the script that I had written. It wasn't, oh, mommy, I'm so sorry. And, oh, mommy, don't you look wonderful. It was about 5 hours of hate. For 5 hours, this young woman spewed her. She was in law school then, and she was very verbal, and she spewed her. she spewed her venom and her hate all over me. But, you know, I was 5 years sober, and I understood that she needed to say what she needed to say. She needed to get out what she thought she remembered. And some of it was the truth. Some of it was right on. Some of it was slightly distorted. Some of it was very distorted. And I'm not sure there weren't some lies sprinkled in there, too. But she thought it was the truth, and I didn't argue. What I did is empathize. My God, honey, how much that must have hurt. My God, honey, how sad that must have made you. Oh, darling, I hadn't... Oh, honey, she didn't want me to call her darling. Oh, honey, I had no idea. No idea. And the next day, and the next day, a couple hours the next day, and the following day, she told me how much she hated me. Okay? But I didn't quit before my miracle. At least my daughter was willing to have some small part of my life. Over the next 19 years, she wandered in and out of it, but I'll finish with that in a few moments. When I was 9.5 years sober, this thing occurred at the treatment center where my younger daughter, Tara, called. The little voice in the phone said, Mother, this is Tara. I was with this patient coming off the Valium, and I stood there, and I couldn't get it to go from here into here. It was 11 years since I'd heard her voice, 9.5 of them sober. And I said, I beg your pardon. And the little voice said again, Mommy, Mother, this is your daughter. This is Tara. And I said, I don't get it. And then the little voice burst into tears, and I would know that voice if I were dead. And she said, Mother, this is your daughter, Tara. And it wasn't sweetness and light, and it wasn't love, and it wasn't, oh, please forgive me that I haven't spoken to you. She hated me. And she told me in the next 10, 15 minutes many of the things that she hated about me, and she was not too inaccurate. She was not too inaccurate, but that's the way I had been. That was not the way I was now. And I empathized, and I told her how sorry I was, and I told her if I could ever make up for it, I would be grateful. And I asked her her phone number because I knew she was in medical school and living in a chicken coop. She was putting herself through medical school because her father and his wife were not willing to help. And she wouldn't take any money from me because she hated my guts. I asked her for her telephone number so that I could call her back so she wouldn't have to pay for the phone call. She hated me so she wouldn't even give me her telephone number. She said if she thought about this, it wasn't as bad as she thought it was going to be, she'd call me back again in a few months. And in a few months, she called me back. And at that time, I was going to one of Conway's conferences in Atlanta. And Tara was a junior in medical school. And I thought if we could meet on neutral territory, if she didn't hear me talk about my alcoholism, but that she heard addicted physicians in recovery talk about their alcoholism, maybe she would. There would be a little forgiveness in her life. So I invited her. She said she'd have to think about it. A week later, she called me back to explain she couldn't meet me that particular weekend because she had and it was the wrong weekend. She had responded to the wrong weekend. And I said to her, doll, I can understand you telling me no, but don't lie. That's the wrong weekend. She said, well, all right, mommy, I'll come. And I said, no, that's coercion. I'm not going to coerce you. I'm going up to say goodbye to grandmother. I'll be at Aunt Jackie's for a few days. Grandma is dying. And if you decide you want to meet me in Atlanta, please call me. Now, talk about God's coincidence and God's miracles. My mother had been praying for my 9 years of recovery that someday my daughters and I would be reunited. My mother was dying. She was in the hospital. For some reason, the physician decided to let her come home for a few days. The housekeeper and I were lifting her into her bed where she had special telephones. She was extremely deaf, and the only way she could hear was on this special telephone. And as we were lifting her into bed, her heart had failed her. The phone rang, and it was Tara. And she said, "Mommy, I have decided to meet you in Atlanta." And I said, "I'm so glad, honey. Would you like to say goodbye to Grandma?" And I handed my mother the phone. For 9 years, my mother had been praying. She had never heard Tara's voice either. And Tara and my mother got to say goodbye to each other. And I went on down to Atlanta. And Tara was going to join me. It was Saturday night, and Sandy Beach was speaking, and I just loved that man. And so I wanted to go down to that. I was torn between waiting upstairs for the limousine from the airport to bring her and going down and hearing him. And so finally I told the people at the desk that my daughter was coming and that I would be downstairs. And half at the break, I guess, I couldn't take it, and I ran upstairs to the desk, and they started shouting, "She's gone downstairs! She's gone downstairs!" And I ran back down the stairs toward the ballroom, which was name was the Tara Ballroom. You talk about God coincidences. And I walked into the ballroom, and there were several hundred people milling around, and all of a sudden I realized I didn't know what my daughter looked like. I didn't know what my daughter looked like. And I stood there looking, and all of a sudden I looked across the room, and there was a very lovely, very slender, tiny young lady, beautiful bouffant, curly hair across the room, very shabby, very poor looking, but very beautiful. And I walked over and I said, "Is your name Tara?" And she said, "Are you my mother? Are you my mother?" And I hadn't quit before my miracle. Hadn't quit before my miracle. The years went by, and Heidi, my older daughter, came in and out of my life. Some of the times that Heidi wouldn't see me was because she remembered what a bad mother I had been. Other times it was because she was doing things in her life that she didn't want me to know about. But a couple of years ago, the phone rang, and it was Heidi. She said, "Ma, what are you doing next week?" I said, "Actually, nothing, honey. I'll be home in Tucson." And she said, "Well, Hal and I aren't doing anything either." That's my granddaughter. She said, "We were wondering if we could come over." And I said, in my 19 years of sobriety at that point, she had never been to see me. I had stopped by and stayed in a hotel and seen her on occasion, but she had never been to see me. I said, "Honey, nothing would make me happier." Heidi and Hallie arrived, and we did things together Monday. We did things together Tuesday. Tuesday evening, my sobriety husband, my significant other, had gone to bed, we weren't married then, as most of you know. We were married for 5 years early in recovery, and then our marriage didn't work, but our divorce didn't work either. For those of you who are curious, it finally worked, okay? It finally worked. No more on that. He's a nice, nice man, as many of you know. Many of you know. Hallie had gone to bed, and David had gone to bed, and Heidi did not want to go to bed, and she and I were sitting in my dining room, which looked out over the city. It was really a very comfortable, cozy time. When I'm with my daughters, as much as they want to be with me, as they seem comfortable, I just sort of sit there like I'm sunbathing. I don't know if any of you mothers do that, but I sort of sunbathe in their nearness and in their... And so I was sort of sunbathing in the evening and the night near Heidi, just sort of enjoying her and being with her and soaking it all in. And she had opened a beer, and she poured half of it down the drain an hour later. And she opened another beer, and she poured, about an hour later, poured half of it down the drain. I'm thinking, don't waste it. You know, you can drink it. Don't waste it. She opened another one, and she looked at me, and she said, "This is probably making you nervous, Mother." I said, "Not the way you're drinking, it's not." And she said, "Well, I'm trying to get up enough courage to say something to you." And I said, "What's that, doll?" And she said, "Well, no, I don't have enough courage." And she said, "You'll interrupt." I said, "No," and my kids know me. I said, no, I won't interrupt. And she said, "I want to say to you something, Mother. It's very important." I said, "Well, what is it, honey?" She said, "You know, Mother, for years you have talked about the harm that you did me in your alcoholism." I interrupted. I said, I did. She said, no. She said, "I don't want to comment about that." She said, "You have always talked about the harm you did me in your alcoholism. I don't know about that, but I certainly do know about the harm I have tried to do you in your recovery." And she said, "I was wondering if after 19 years we could call it even and start fresh tonight." And I said, "Honey, nothing would make me happier." And I hadn't quit before my miracle. And I pray to God that you all don't do either. Thank you.